So, Victoria Castle, my very first day when I was in suburban Seattle at my church there, they booked a guest speaker, and it was Victoria Castle, so I didn't get to speak my first Sunday, which maybe that was a blessing, who knows. Victoria is something else. She's really sophisticated. She's really smart. She's really companionable. She has all the credits that are appropriate of being the coaching consultant and the Microsoft thing and the Boeing thing and all of this, which is very meaningful credits. Has had success in many areas, wrote an utterly superb book called The Trance of Scarcity. I remember on that first day when I introduced her, I said that Victoria wrote a book called The Scance of Trancity, which was not the title. The title is The Trance of Scarcity. But, you know, the thing that's most important, I think, about Victoria is that she is about the business of helping others. And I don't think I want to say anything more than that, other than would you welcome Victoria Castle to our platform.
What a beautiful sight. A room full of deviants. Well, exactly. Positive deviants, of which John is one of my favorite. But to deviate means I am aware of something enough to choose something else. So the status quo, or the unquestioned, or the norm, most of us here have chosen something different than that, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, and very intentionally. So it is something to be proud about. Hi, I'm a deviant. How are you? Well, I think one of the key things for us in New Thought is about questioning, really looking. Why do we say that so? Is that actually useful? Why would I give my allegiance to that? But you can't question what you can't see. And that's where my book came from, The Trance of Scarcity. Because there was something about this. Well, here's what happened. In my life, my own experience, and pretty much everybody I talked to had some story running of, I'm not enough. There's not enough, it can't work, it's too late, something about not. And I thought, that is just wrong. That we are innately divine, yet we carry this story that so impedes us and restricts who we are. So I was sitting in meditation one day, asking, what is this? How can this be so pervasive? And those of you who might remember The Groucho Show. Remember, he'd ask for the answer and it would float down the duck or whatever. Well, it was almost like that, and what showed up in front of me is, it's a trance. A trance that flies beneath the radar. We don't see it, so we don't question it. So this story, basically, that lack, struggle, and separation are our defining reality. Now go out there and be great. But that's your starting place. And when I finally saw it, it was something, it was insidious, it was unchecked, and it became more and more concretized as people gave allegiance to it. And so I wrote a book about it, because I really had to figure it out. And the basic premise I have found in my life and all the different work I've done and the wonderful teachers that I've been with is that the quality of our life is determined most by our state, not by our circumstances. Would you say that so for you? I mean, that's really what we study and practice. It's my state of being. So I started to pull that apart about what generates our state. And in my studies, two things showed up. One is story, the stories we tell ourselves. And the other is soma, and I'll talk about that more in a minute, the embodiment of those stories, how we literally shape our lives around the stories that we tell ourselves. So the power of story, and mostly what that means, is we humans are meaning makers. With no effort on our part, something occurs, and we interpret it and decide what it means. So one of the stories I tell in my book, this is not quite a tell-all about me. There is other stuff in there, but I use myself a lot as examples. So when I was in high school, I think it was a sophomore, I went to a dance after a football game and with my friends, and a guy asked me to dance from another school, and it's like, oh boy, and we danced together a lot, and at the end he said, give me your number, I'll call you. And I said, okay, and pretty much went home and sat at the phone, because he was going to call me. He said he was going to call me, so he was going to call me. So that was Friday night, and, you know, Saturday I didn't go anywhere, and Sunday, as soon as I got home from church, I was right there, and I had to go to school, but he had to be at school, so that was all right. And he didn't call, and he didn't call, and it was probably Wednesday, and by this point, I had decided what it meant. This will be my life. No one will ever call me. I will be alone. Or, he's spreading rumors about my site. My number's now on the wall of the boys' bathroom. Or he's laughing with his friends, or all those kind of things. I was in agony. So I finally asked my brother, who was 2 years older. He was a senior. He knew everything. And so I remember standing in his door kind of like this and said, and he was studying at his desk, Marshall, what does it mean when a guy calls you and then he doesn't call? And without even looking up, he said, it means he didn't call. And at the moment, I thought that was really heartless of him, but it was incredibly liberating because the only fact I had was he said he would call. Everything else, all the misery, all the suffering, all the futurizing, I had conjured all by myself. So stories, the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we live in, the stories we align ourselves to, greatly determine our state of being, our experience of life. And it's wired in us. You know, back in the days when we were literally living in caves and there were predators and dangers all around us, if I'm alone walking through the forest and I hear a twig snap behind me, I have a nanosecond to decide what that means. Do I run like crazy? Do I turn and fight? Or I just freeze in hopes that I won't be seen? So it's wired in for us to interpret, and it's a beautiful facility to have as long as we know we are interpreting, that we're bringing the meaning to it. So that's half of what creates our experience or our state. The other half is soma. The Greek word soma literally means the living being as a whole system, inclusive of all of it, not cut off at the neck. You know, Cartesian thinking is like, we'll take this, let's get rid of this part. So somatic is the whole being as a living, full intelligence. You know, it's our thinking, feeling, emotions, sensations, perceptions, habits, all of that. And when I started studying somatics, I went, well, that's what's been missing. That's why I've been doing all these affirmations and nothing's coming through. And I thought, either there's something wrong with the spirit part, or more than likely, there's something wrong with me. Well, I was trying to do it from the neck up. Any of you had this experience? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to be fully embodied, so that I have access to all of that. Because, you know, our habits don't just live in our mind. They literally live in our nervous system. They live in our tissue. Think about how you drive a car. You're not thinking about it all that time, and don't pretend you are. Or anything, brushing our teeth, or any of the things that we've done. So how does something become embodied? We do it over and over. We practice it. We practice. In fact, I remember one of my teachers saying, we are the products of what we practice. It's pretty much what we say in here. What do I give my allegiance to? What do I give my attention to? How do I spend my life energy? Am I spending it on repeating old habits, or am I spending it on and investing it in living the divine? So this whole embodied self, very different from conceptual. It's like conceptually eating a perfectly ripe peach, or embodyingly eating a perfect ripe peach. Which one would you rather have? Now, the peach can be a little drippy, you know, so you eat it like this. But I also saw in that, too, that I can have an interpretation that it's messy or that it's juicy. Once again, my experience of it is based on how I see it, how I choose to hold it, to perceive it, to relate to it. So we're the product of our practices. For years, I was in the practice of, I'm going to start my diet tomorrow. That was the practice I was going to start. I was not getting results with that practice at all. But I had to see what I was doing because I was basically conning myself. So I'm going to ask you to do something while you're sitting there. If you will just kind of, nobody's going to look at you. We're all too self-absorbed to pay attention to what anybody else is doing. So just squeeze down. Just really squeeze down, and I can see you, so don't act like you're cool. Squeeze down. Hold your breath. Hunker down. Hold it. And then just to yourself say, I have infinite choices. How's that feel? Little incongruent, right? Okay. Then shake that off. Really let yourself take up all of the space around you as if you were filling the air. And now with full breath and a very relaxed body, same message. I have infinite choices. How does that one feel? More congruent, right? Because story and soma are just flip sides of each other. So if I go around like this, pretty soon, I'll have a story that matches it. And if I go around with, I have infinite choices, pretty soon, I'll have a soma that matches it. So there's two ways that we're basically creating our reality, our experience, in any moment. And that's where I would say that state is more important than circumstances. Because what we do with circumstances is interpret them and relate to them. So it isn't the facts that get us. It's our perceptions, our rationalization, our explanation. Those are the ones that we become loyal to. And so I think about some of the things I was raised with, some of the things you were raised with. One of mine was, people don't like little girls who are loud. That was very problematic for me. But given that my mother said it, it must have been the truth. So at a pretty young age, I decided, okay, being loved or being liked is more important than being loud, so I'll just shut it off. Anybody done that?
Yes.
So it got to the point where this person who likes to be at the microphone, who likes to be in the front of the room, who wants to take up space, who has things I want to share that I think are useful, I really had to come to a choice point of, I still believe that story was true, right? I didn't know about interpretation yet, but I got to the point where, okay, then I won't be liked as much or loved as much, but I have to be who I am. And then I came to this part of seeing like, oh my God, it's all a story. I got a new story. People love girls who are loud. Or maybe a more useful story. And see, that's really the thing about any of our interpretations. It's not about them being right or wrong or good or bad. It's, are they useful given what we care about? Are they useful? It's just a story. So am I living in a, if I'm living in a story of there's not enough, I'm not enough, there's not enough love, there's not enough time, there's not enough cooperation, there's not enough possibility, or I couldn't, I'm too old, young, rich, poor, you put anything on there, that's a story. Given what you deep in your heart care about, what you want for yourself and for this world, what's a useful story? And then what's the embodiment of that story? You know, there's a reason often when we're singing, our hands go up, because it's congruent to the message. I am free, I am unlimited. Probably not. In the religious upbringing that I had, kind of the message was, to be really spiritual, you gotta get rid of the body. Get up, rise above it, rise above the gross reality, the denseness. Did you get that kind of message too, perhaps? I think many of us did, you know, particularly. Well, I'm thinking I was raised Protestant and it was all about being neat and tidy, not about having a deep experience. So the story was, okay, I need to keep rising above this thing called a living being and detach myself from it, when the invitation really is to become, come fully in, drop in, get here, land, to embody, where I can feel my breath, where I can be self-aware and self-referring, and notice when I'm starting to clench, when I'm starting to get that, uh-oh, this is never going to work out. Who do I think I? And go, whoa, 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 wait a minute. That's a choice. I can make another choice, because all it is a story, and there's a billion of them. As I worked more in somatics and embodiment and became a somatic practitioner and was working with other people and then brought that work into corporations, which was so beautiful to see because people are starving for meaning. And at first I thought, ooh, I don't know if I want to go there. Into corporations? All I found were people that wanted to make a difference and wanted to see how to do that. And as they became more embodied, the kind of interactions they had, the kind of listening that became available, the way they were with each other, where there was genuine love and concern going on, not like touchy-feely, if that wasn't the place, but that it was genuine, it was coherent. It was like, sure, I care about you people. Sure, yes, whatever your names are, of which I will never learn. It wasn't that, it was more like, hey guys, there's a lot of us, what are we up to here? Something became very clear to me about the more embodied I am, the more access I have to spirit, because it's aliveness. Oh yeah, come on into the body. Make friends with this sacred vessel. That was a great relief for me. And has brought me enormous joy because I can see that I was enjoying life from here up, kind of like thinking about eating a peach or really eating a peach. So the book was written because my expertise was in struggle. Not in ease. I knew that place and I knew it was off, so I just kept looking and exploring it and seeing what are the practices of actually embodying wholeness, belonging, connection, flow, trading struggle for ease. It's like they're both, what? Points of view. They're both habits. Which habit do I want to be in? So the book is full of practices as well as stories. And as my husband Tim said, you should just buy it for the quotes alone. And that was one of the great joys of writing a book, is all those quotes that I'd saved for years, here's where I get to use them. when we are connected to spirit, when we really know our oneness, when we're there, in fact, let your soma find that now, when you know you are one with the one, then everything is unlimited and is possible. We don't have to trick ourselves into believing it. We are so connected and a part of it that we're in the infinite. Everything is possible. In contrast to when we're operating from separation, from the not belonging, from the I don't deserve, from the separate from, limited, then what do I see and what do I expect? More limitation and more separation. I might wish that there was going to be great, but my body expects limitation and separation. So how do I reside more deeply in this sense of spirit? My definition, so embodied abundance is the phrase that I like. My definition of abundance is living in the world with ease. Sure, that includes money and resource, but it's all of it. Living in the world with ease, regardless of circumstances, because I'm putting my attention and my energy where I want it to be. I am deviating purposely. I'm choiceful. I'm awake enough that I'm not swept over by the trance and following the norm. So that doesn't mean there's more money on the world, in the planet than we think there is. I'm not talking about quantity at all. I'm talking about orientation and relationship, how I engage. And if I am embodied, part of that is I'm developing my capacity to notice when I'm starting to go to the clinch and returning to the flow. So the more I practice, I can tell you now when I start to hold my breath, or when my legs are really stiff and my energy's coming up and I can't feel my feet on the floor anymore. Or there's that tightening in the jaw. My savvy husband watches for the tightening in the jaw as to when to relate to me or not. But the more I notice it, the quicker I can adjust and come back to that place of center, of flow, of wholeness, of one with the one. And then from that place, there's nothing in me that will entertain the thought of, oh no, it could never be, you don't deserve, those people are who, they don't matter. It's just not there. It's a state of being. To me, that's the key, the state of being. And I have dominion over the state. Yahoo! In one area of my life, I have dominion. So I talk in the book about the cycle of abundance, which is just different stages of how to fully be in the flow. And one of them is about, one is receiving and one is gratitude. And I see for many people, receiving is the biggest challenge. We all want to give. But often we're giving from empty, or we're giving from, I wish it was, as opposed to fully attending to being so filled that I can't help but spill over. Like John, autumn is my favorite season. And it's also the season of the harvest, of thanksgiving, and of gratitude. So let yourself for a moment just feel how you feel when you're really full and grateful. Really savor that for a moment and just notice what it feels like all the way down to your toes. This is when we come into the present moment where you could say we're of most earthly good, where we really can be of service. And if I had t-shirts for you, this is what they'd say. If struggling was the way to get there, we'd all be there by now. Bless you.